this lecture's on phenomenology, the subject of phenomenology, and there's a handout. I've done a handout for you instead of a PowerPoint because there's quite a lot of quotes and some figures that you may not have come across before. The handouts aren't here yet. Katia's just running off to go and get them. So they'll sort of come in a sort of awkward way halfway through probably. But don't worry. I mean, I'm not sure that the quotes start to come in for a while. But let me just kind of tell you the structure of the lecture so you've got a sense of what I'm going to talk about. I'll give you an overview of what phenomenology is and why it's important for us as literary critics to read. And then I'm going to focus on Wolfgang Eiser's essay on phenomenology, which is in your theory textbooks. But then what I'm going to do is go on to talk about the two figures that influence Eiser, because I think you can focus on Eiser quite a lot in your seminars and go through that essay. And Eiser's a lot more readable than the figures that influence him. The figures that influence him are Martin Heidegger and Georges Poulet. And those names are on your handout, so that you'll have the spelling and all of the quotations and all the references to their work. So you don't need to worry about that. Now, phenomenology is a subject that's it's interesting because it's seen still by some people as quite outdated, although it's one of these subjects that's sort of come recently back into fashion. I was editing a book recently on Wordsworth, the greatest poet ever lived or ever will live, and there was a chapter on phenomenology in there. And the editors wanted to take the chapter out because they said nobody cares about phenomenology anymore. You know, keep the chapters on history and politics and feminism and post-colonialism and Marxism and all that kind of thing, but boot the chapter on phenomenology, which I think is sort of problematic, you know, for lots of reasons, but partly because it is, as I say, coming back into fashion, partly because of the return of formalism. And again, formalism, which we've talked about before, this kind of close attention to texts, used to be perceived as something that was quite out of date. Now people are starting to work on it again. They just call it neo-formalism. So I suppose we could talk about neo-phenomenology if we wanted to, but, you know, we don't want too many words there. So let me just talk about what phenomenology is. Basically, it's the study of structures of human experience, i.e. consciousness. How do we have an experience in the world? How does our consciousness register what's going on around us? So phenomenology is literally the study of phenomena, the appearance of things, or things as they appear in our experience of them, the way we experience things. So there's a slight difference between the object on the table here, a biro on the table. There's a difference between the being of that object and the way in which I would experience using that object. That's what phenomenology is interested in. And it's concerned to work through the meanings things have in the specific experience of the individual. So it's very interested in coming back to the idea of the individual reader again and weighting or forefronting the reader's experience as primary over that of the author. So it's, you know, certainly Barth is interested in phenomenology and is kind of coming out of that tradition, albeit sort of shifting it. Now, phenomenology is concerned to study the structures of various types of experience. And the main types of experience that it's interested in are what we might roughly call sort of philosophical ways of approaching the world. Perception, thought, memory, imagination, emotion, desire, bodily senses, bodily awareness, that those structures are the thing that it's interested in looking at. But it's also very interested in thinking about the idea of linguistic activity. What is our experience of speaking? What is our experience of understanding words? Now, the figure that is associated with inventing phenomenology, although we can't really say anyone invented it, but the sort of perceived founder of it, is a figure called Edmund Husserl, H-U-S-S-E-R-L. And again, he's on your handout, so you don't need to worry about all the spellings here. But the founder of phenomenology, Husserl, he's interested in the way in which the structure of experience is dominated by intentionality. So you can already see how that's very different from some of the more politicized ways of reading you've looked at. So according to Husserl, our experience is directed towards, that is, it represents or intends things only through particular concepts, thoughts, ideas, images, and so on. These make up the meaning or content of a given experience and are distinct from the things they present or mean. So I think it's a kind of very delicate kind of difference, but again, it's that idea of what's the difference between our intended experience of something and the thing itself. The key essay in your Lodgen Wood anthology that addresses phenomenology, as I mentioned, is Wolfgang Eiser's The Reading Process, A Phenomenological Approach, which is an essay that's concerned to ask how we study conscious experience in order to think more about the reading process. So Eiser's taking that idea of focusing on consciousness to think about that in terms of just the actual activity of reading, physically, how we sit down and read a book. So he both means how we read as in kind of this course, modes of reading, but he also means what do we do when we read, what's the physical action of reading. Phenomenologists would say that we need to reflect on various types of experiences as we experience them. However, we don't normally characterize an experience at the time we're performing it, so we don't normally kind of think about our conscious experience as we're having it, and that's what Eiser's interested in. So in many cases, we don't have the capability to kind of reflect on our own experience at all. A state of intense anger or fear, for example, consumes all of your sort of psychic focus at the time. You don't think, I am now being angry, when you're being angry at somebody, because that experience sort of overwhelms you. So what Eiser says is that we acquire a background of having lived through a given type of experience, and we look to our familiarity with that type of experience and then describe it, which is why phenomenologists are interested in the function of memory. How is it that we remember conscious experiences? So conscious experience is the starting point of phenomenology, but we're only vaguely aware of things as we experience them, says Eiser. We can do our own exercise in phenomenology by considering some everyday experiences as characterized in the first person. And again, I've written all of these sentences on your handout, but this would be a kind of a phenomenological way of reflecting on different kinds of experience. I intend to finish my essay by... Oh, here's the handouts. Fantastic. Thank you, Cheryl. So as they come around, I'll read these sentences out. As I say, that these are different characterizations of phenomenological experience. I intend to finish my essay by 8 o'clock. I wish that it would stop snowing. I hear the traffic go past as I read my book. I go up the elevator and stop at the fifth floor. I am making a cup of tea. I imagine what it would be like to fly. I am thinking that phenomenology differs from psychology. That sense of doing everything in the first person is what phenomenologists are interested in thinking about and pushing you to kind of think about your actions in the first person so that you can reflect on them better. So each of these sentences that I just read out, they're on your handouts, is a simple form of phenomenological description, articulating in everyday way the structure of the type of experience is described. The subject term I indicates the first person structure of the experience. The intentionality proceeds from the subject. So Eiser's interested in the way objects of awareness are presented or intended in our experiences, especially the way in which we think or conceive about reading. As we interpret the phenomenological description further, we may then assess the relevance of context of experience. So Eiser's interested in the way in which we can kind of think about our first-person experience of the world, but then also examine the context that we're having that experience in, which is why Eiser is sort of politicizing phenomenology. He wants to think about, you know, what it would be like to kind of experience an object as a woman or as a man or a different types of identity. So in this way, the practice of phenomenology is basically a kind of sense of classifying, describing, interpreting, and analyzing structures of experiences in a way that help us to understand our experience of the world. Phenomenology is really tricky because in some ways it sounds really basic. It sounds like it's just asking you to sort of dissect your experience of the world and reflect on it over and over again. which is what it's asking you to do. But that process is very, very difficult. But you can see the reason literary critics would be interested in it, right? Because that's what we do when we close read. You just dissect the text and reflect on it over and over again. And I think the reason phenomenology is sort of important is because it teaches you how to really pull apart a text and reflect on the words without constantly turning to outside sources to explain it away. And I think that's what phenomenology is resisting, is that kind of urge to go and look up a Wikipedia entry on a subject before you read about it. So if you're just reading a poem, you know, by William Blake, for example, or, you know, Howl, let's think about Howl, it'd be interesting to think of, you know, your experience of that poem, how many of you went and looked, you know, Googled Howl or Googled Ginsberg before you read that. What's the difference between that experience and just getting into the text itself and not relying on any outside material at all? Now, of course, you know, I did give you some outside material on Howl, but I think those of you who are doing literature in the modern world, you know, that course is placing Ginsberg in a historical, lineage. It's interested in the context, if you like, whereas this course isn't really interested in that. It's interested more in thinking about the actual words on the page and teaching you how to kind of do that mode of reflection and articulate that and translate that into an essay, which I think is very, very difficult. It's much trickier, in fact, than just kind of finding a load of historical context to turn to. So let's think a little bit more about how Isa teaches us to do this reading experience. Isa does this by suggesting that the experience of reading literature, quote, gives us the chance to formulate the unformulated. It's a really key bit of his essay, to formulate the unformulated. He does this in a discussion of indeterminacy, where he suggests that the gaps or blanks in literary texts, the spaces around a poem, deliberate moments of confusion or disruption, questions purposefully raised but not answered, give the reader a freedom to construct and shape meanings and answers that would not otherwise have come into existence or into being. Now, that word being is a key word for phenomenologists. So if you only remember one thing from the lecture, just remember phenomenology equals being. And hopefully at some point you'll sort of understand the link between that as I talk through it. But that sense of phenomenologists being interested in the experience of our personal experience of the world leads them to push us to reflect back on our own being. How are we able to be in the experience that we're having? And for Isa, I think what he's suggesting is that if you read texts in a kind of linear way for the plot, you're only going to get a very limited set of meanings out of them, and they're going to be meanings that we'll just keep repeating over and over again in history. It'll just keep supporting readings that everybody knows and are familiar with, and that is a kind of apolitical way of reading because it just supports the status quo. Whereas reading in a phenomenological way, where you kind of think about bits of the text that don't make sense, or bits of the text that seem to go wrong, or sound wrong, or non sequiturs in the text, that sort of thing, that's the key thing that phenomenologists want you to reflect on, because they want to know what your experience of that is. What is your experience of being confused about the text, and how do you talk about that in a kind of intelligent way? So Isa privileges this kind of dynamic and always shifting way in which we respond to texts. And this way, as I said before, his argument is very Barthesian. Like Barthes, he sees reading as a creative and imaginative activity. What phenomenology does, Isa says, is force us to get involved with this imaginative reading experience at the level of consciousness, to feel, he argues, quote, involved in events which at the time of reading seem real to us. And that's very important. This quote's on your handout. He says, the product of this creative activity is what we might call the virtual dimension of the text, which endows it with its reality. This virtual dimension is not the text itself, nor is it the imagination of the reader. It is the coming together of text and imagination. What he's trying to get at is that sort of sense of reading that you feel when, you know, you're so intensely into a text that you start to kind of dream about it and think the events are real and relate to the characters as if they're kind of real people. And he recognizes that there's a mode of reading in which you're in that reality, and then of course you kind of break out of that reality if the phone rings or you have to go out or you make a cup of tea or something. But he wants to sort of examine that relationship between the text and the imagination and try and think about the crossover between that and how we can sort of pull that apart. So from this relationship between text and imagination, Iser argues, we can identify three aspects of the reading experience. The first is that it involves us constantly anticipating and reflecting on what we're reading. That's important to him. And again, remember that, you know, it's very similar to what Barthes says about the readerly and the writerly text. There's books that you read because you just want to get through them and you can skip loads of stuff and you don't really care because you just want to get to the end of the book because you want to know what the end is. And there's writerly texts which really involve you. Iser wants us to read everything in a writerly way. He says that that's the responsible way to read. So out of his three aspects of the reading experience, that first one is that he involves us in constantly anticipating and reflecting on what we're reading. Second, he says that we need to think about relating to the text as a living event, the text as a living event that moves and breathes with us, as if the text is somehow organic and has a sort of life of its own. And third, he says reading involves us in a lifelike moment in which we're drawn into the text and provoked into developing an attitude or stance towards it. And notably, even if this stance is different from that the author intended. So you have to, what he's saying is, like, work out what your position is on this text and stand next to it and reflect on it and think about it. And don't be kind of pushed by other people's readings into kind of doubting your own experience, because it will be your experience. I was teaching a poem the other day. I don't know if people know this poem by Simon Armitage called Killing Time, where he talks about the Columbine shootings, and he replaces all of the imagery of guns with flowers. It was a third year group, and you know, I could see that, you know, the majority of the group hated the poem. They thought it was really terrible. You know, they thought it was offensive and all the rest of it. I could see there was this one student there that didn't agree, but she didn't want to say anything. And you don't want to be like, "What do you think?" and kind of push people into sort of saying something. But at the same time, I could recognize that she didn't agree with them, but she wasn't sort of willing to sort of say, "I've got a different experience of this poem." But, you know, for all those sorts of reasons that people don't want to talk in seminars, which of course you know about. But I mean, I think the point I'm trying to get at is that there's a reason that people have vastly different reading experiences of text. It's not because some people are clever and are right and some people are, you know, not so clever and wrong. It's because we've got these massively different experiences of the text, and that will provoke us to have hugely varying meanings, even if those meanings or interpretations are totally different from that even the tutor's trying to tell you to think about. So Iser is trying to defend the right, I think, of the sort of the wrong interpretation, if you like, because if the experience is right, you know, it justifies the interpretation. Now, one of the things that Iser says at the end of the essay, as you'll know if you've read it, is that he says in order to understand the experience of reading, the phenomenological experience of reading, we have to go back to Georges Poulet's work, which I'm going to do shortly by looking at his essay, The Phenomenology of Reading, which was written in 1969. Before doing this, though, we've got to go back to the philosopher who gives us this term being, as a way of explaining what effect the reading experience has. And that's this figure, Martin Heidegger, and his 1950 essay, Language. So where Iser and Poulet analyze how we read, Heidegger analyzes how we speak, and how this process shapes the way in which we articulate our interpretation of texts. So he's very interested in the kind of, you know, the one person in the seminar who would have a different sort of experience or think about things in a different way. People have got lots of mixed feelings about Heidegger. He is quite a difficult philosopher to read, there's no question about that. Also, people sort of found out, like, in the 70s or something, that, like, he had these sympathies with the Nazi party, and so then everyone started to hate him and say that we shouldn't read him, which is sort of, you know, my opinion is that's ridiculous, and people would have different opinions, of course, but, I mean, obviously we're sort of following a kind of death of the author line. Heidegger's kind of, I think, relationship to his own history is a very interesting one. And a lot of his philosophy about being is really a sort of sense of trying to work out why he's got the views that he has. And I think for literary critics, we're sort of on safer territory, because by the time he's getting on to writing all of his stuff about poetry, he's sort of changed his mind and, you know, become a goodie and, you know, doesn't like the Nazis anymore. So let me just, you know, go through a little bit about Heidegger and tell you why I think he's important. He begins as a theology student, which, you know, I think is interesting. And he's specifically concerned when he's a theology student in questions about how we should live authentically. That's his word. So he's, as an undergraduate, he's obsessed with, like, all the authentic experience of the world and with integrity. And with integrity. How do you live with integrity and authenticity in a very kind of complex and confusing world? You know, how do you do it? I mean, do any of us do that? And he wants to push us to ask that question. You know, it's that kind of sense of, you know, can you be a Marxist and, you know, still have cleaners sort of thing? That sort of sense of being in a tension between two different roles and having integrity is what he's interested in. I don't know whether Heidegger had cleaners. I doubt it. I think he was quite messy. So Heidegger uses phenomenology to explore this question of integrity, and he does so by rejecting the dualism between the mind and the body, between subject and object, and between the separation of the idea of mind and experience. That's massively important. You know, anyone who knows anything about kind of basic kind of philosophy knows that philosophy is built on the idea that the mind and body are separate. I mean, you don't need to know anything about philosophy to kind of, you know, just have a, you know, an idiot's guide to Plato. Plato says, you know, that the body's kind of got these two, is led by two horses, right? There's a mean black horse who's kind of stamping his feet and he's always cross and he's the emotions and he's pulling us one way. And then there's a nice, like, white horse that's kind of trotting around in a kind of good way, and that's reason, and he's kind of leading you in the other way. And that sort of sense of the kind of passion, thought being pulling you in different directions is what Western philosophy, not Eastern, is based on. And Heidegger's saying, I don't think that's true. I think that's rubbish. That the mind and the body are one. You can't kind of separate them. Everything that happens in your body is controlled by the brain anyway. So that dualism is fundamentally wrong. So he challenges the idea that our primary relationship to the world is one of knowledge, and says that instead we're driven by a personalized search for authenticity. So he says that, you know, even though philosophers think that they're kind of trying to work towards a model of knowledge, what they're really trying to do is to reflect back on themselves. So he starts this search for authenticity by asking the question, what does it mean to be in the world? What does it mean to have being? And early phenomenologists like Husserl, who taught Heidegger, so Edmund Husserl, founder of phenomenology, teaches Heidegger, argues that being can be found in experience and our consciousness of this experience. Heidegger, however, says that being is always situated in the world. We might not understand the world we're situated in, but we are in it simply by living in a specific place at a specific time. And he calls this being in the worldness idea Dasein. That's his German word for it, and I put that on your handouts. These words will constantly come up over and over again in literary criticism that you read during your degree that has a kind of philosophical formal bent. Historical criticism isn't so interested in these ideas, but philosophical criticism is. So that sort of sense of being in the world, Dasein, is a word that suggests that we can somehow analyse our sense of pure being. What does it mean to be? And the key thing about this notion of Dasein, and I think in the German it holds this idea, is that it rejects the dualism of mind and body. There is no distinction between thinking and bodily experience in being, in Dasein. Now, the implication of this is that the self can't be consciously understood, but only conjured up in moments of self-recognition, which we find in our relationship with language and with reading. And that's why Heidegger and Isa cross over. So for Heidegger, language brings man and his world into existence. Language is not mimetic, it's not expressive, it does not represent the world out there, and it does not represent pre-existing feelings or thoughts. There's no world before language, says Heidegger. Language shapes consciousness and perception, and it calls things into being. So there isn't a world without language. Nothing outside the text, to paraphrase old Jacques Derrida. Now, poetry in particular, for Heidegger, so he's interested in poetry, poetry in particular shows us what language really is, because poetry is less concerned with communication and expression, he argues, than with imaginative creation. So if he's interested in the way in which language calls things into being rather than kind of bluntly describes them, poetry is his thing, right? Because poetry is more oblique. It kind of tends to hint and imply rather than describe. And what he does in the essay is does this very kind of long, quite complicated, I think, analysis of a poem called A Winter Evening, which is on your handout, by George Trackle. I'm just going to read the poem to you and then summarize what Heidegger says about it. When snow falls against the window, long sounds the evening bell. For so many has the table been prepared, the house set in order. From their wandering, many come on dark paths to this gateway. The tree of grace is flowering in gold out of the cool sap of the earth. In stillness, wanderer, step in. Grief has worn the threshold into stone. But see, in pure light glowing there on the table, bread and wine. Now, Heidegger, in his essay Language, analyzes the poem by writing poetically. So he does a creative project, if you like, on the poem to try and describe it. And what he does is he's deliberately obscure in his analysis. It's a very frustrating essay to read, I think, in many ways. But he wants to try and capture or perform, if you like, the many difficulties that we encounter in reading poetry and translating our experience of poetry back into language. He begins by arguing, quote, that only speech enables man to be the living being he is as a man. So not only does language call everything else into being, but it allows us to be human. If we didn't have language, we wouldn't be human, he says. We wouldn't have any humanity either, any integrity. So there's a kind of very important significance for Heidegger in that idea of being a human. Language is not an expression or the representation of reality, but constitutes the human itself. This is another quote from Heidegger. It is language that first brings man about, brings him into existence. So what he's saying is that man is spoken by language. Man is spoken by language. Now, Heidegger argues that this Trackle poem, which you may want to kind of have a look at again, because it's quite a complicated and I think quite beautiful poem, works through these ideas of being called into being by refusing to simply name things. So it doesn't just kind of describe snow, bells, windows, falling, ringing, etc. Rather, it calls those things into words. The famous line in Heidegger's essay is, "The naming calls." That's his famous quote. That idea of the language calling these ideas into being. And I think one way of thinking about this statement, "The naming calls," is that Heidegger is trying to say things are not sitting around waiting to be named by language. Things only achieve their status as things by being called into words, only by being given a status, a position, a situation in language. Things achieve their very thingyhood, their thingness, only in the process of being called into being. But this process, for Heidegger, is dependent on the consciousness of the reader, as we've got to think things into being. When we read Trackle's poem, Heidegger says, the things described start to mean in relation to each other. For example, if you just take, but see in pure light glowing there on the table, bread and wine, you're driven to see that bread and wine in a kind of religious way. I mean, we could see the words bread and wine and think, okay, that's probably a sort of description of the communion. But also, just bread and wine is just bread and wine. But Heidegger's saying that the bread and wine is kind of called into being through its relationship with the other words in the poem, through that kind of pure light that's glowing on the table that kind of gives it this sort of, the bread and wine a sacred meaning. So Heidegger says that the things described in language start to mean in relationship to each other, suggesting that things are brought into being by revealing their shared relationship, by bringing into light the world that they evoke. And Heidegger's other big example of the world coming into being through language is the start of the Book of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That sort of idea of there's nothing else before language is what Heidegger kind of works from. Now let's go on to think about Poulet's work, who is similarly, who's influenced by Heidegger, and then Isaac's kind of taking on from Poulet. Poulet approaches the same questions that Heidegger does in his essay, the Phenomenology of Reading. But he moves the focus from language to the act of reading itself. And he really is trying to think about how it is that we read. For him, the special virtue of reading is that it gives man access to another mind, another person's consciousness of experience. So we can work out how we have experiences of the world by working out how this author has had a kind of conscious experience of the world. To start reading a book does not mean entering into an impersonal realm created by words for Poulet. It means entering another consciousness, making reading a distinct experience different from looking at other kinds of object. And this is a quote on your handouts from the first quote from Poulet, where he's talking about why reading is different from looking at other things. Buy a vase, take it home, put it on your table or on your mantle, and after a while, it will allow itself to be made a part of your household. But it will be no less a vase for that. On the other hand, take a book, and you will find it offering, opening itself. It is this openness of the book which I find so moving. A book is not shut in by its contours, is not walled up as in a fortress. It asks nothing better than to exist outside of itself, or to let you exist in it. In short, the extraordinary fact in the case of a book is the falling away of the barriers between you and it. You are inside it, it is inside you. There is no longer either outside or inside. So for Poulet, reading is the process, the consciousness of the critic, is the process of the consciousness of the critic interacting with the consciousness of the author being analysed. Second quote from Poulet, I am a self who is granted the experience of thinking thoughts foreign to him. I am the subject of thoughts other than my own. My consciousness behaves as though it were the consciousness of another. And you can see how Poulet is developed by, say, French feminists, like Ségsu and Irigaray, where that kind of sense of the text being in you and inside you, I mean, it's deliberately sexualized language, right, that you're kind of having this very intimate moment, with the book. And I think that sort of sense of Poulet's stress on your consciousness being sort of entering into the consciousness of another and kind of temporarily taking over that mind space, that relationship isn't one of dialogue for Poulet, actually. It's not one where you're kind of interacting with the author. It's one in which you're actually entering in or taking over the author, as if you're placing themselves in their body. So there's no kind of battle going on between your thoughts and the author's thoughts. You're kind of getting in to the author's head. The reason that the death of the author stuff still works with this is because obviously it's still your experience. So you're ventriloquizing the author, and you're sort of guessing, I suppose, the conscious experience that the author is having in the text. And of course, you can replace the word author with narrator anyway and suggest that you're somehow in the head of the narrator. A book like Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea would be a good example there. The figure Antoine is constantly inviting you to kind of get into his head, you know, even though we don't really want to be in there because he's always bored and depressed and suicidal. So this sense of reading a book is achieved, I think, as a way of a sort of a coincidence, that's how Poulet puts it, of the reader's mind with the author's mind, where the reader becomes a kind of neutral power of comprehension. This neutrality is not a lazy yielding to the narrator, though, but a process of mental reimagining where we almost sacrifice or self-efface ourselves to become a vessel for the narrator. Poulet wants to remove the ego from our experience of reading and suggests that the reader must recreate the mind of the narrator in our own minds. That sense of removing the ego is really important for Poulet and Heidegger and Iser. You know, what they're saying is there's a way in which we read that's very ego-driven. We want the book to reflect our world. We want it to reflect our thoughts. Or, if we don't like it, we want to somehow kind of have a scrap with it and have a battle with it and say, oh, I don't like that poem because it expresses ideas that I don't like. That sense of our own egos and our own thoughts and judgments getting in the way of reflecting on what's happening in the text, in the words, is what Poulet kind of wants to get rid of. This is the third quote from Poulet. When I read as I ought, i.e. without mental reservation, without any desire to preserve my independence of judgment, and with the total commitment required of any reader, my comprehension becomes intuitive, and any feeling proposed to me is immediately assumed by me. In other words, the kind of comprehension in question here is not a movement from the unknown to the known, from the strange to the familiar, from outside to inside. It might rather be called a phenomenon by which mental objects rise up from the depths of consciousness into the light of recognition. That sense of shedding light on the text, shedding light on the world. It's a very deeply, again, it's biblical image, that idea of light coming in and giving meaning, but without kind of telling you what to think, just sort of lighting something up. And I think Poulet never tries to reach through his identification with the mind of the narrator, anything beyond or outside that mind. Material objects, other people, context, and so on, they're all present in Poulet's criticism, but only as they have been turned into language, into a form of consciousness. So Poulet's response to the kind of historicist who says, well, what about all the kind of historical background, would be, well, how are you experiencing that anyway? Have you thought about your experience of that Wikipedia line that's just told you when this poem's written, or the content of the poem? Well, what's your experience of that world? So everything that exists has to exist as contained in the bubble of the mind of the narrator of the text. And that bubble has to remain intact and not burst. You burst that bubble and your sensitive reading has gone out the window and you're just kind of writing kind of clunky analysis, is what Poulet says. Okay, so Poulet says, you know, we've identified with this other mind. We've kind of had a sort of consciousness in another consciousness. What do we do then? Poulet says. He says, well, though reading is in one sense a purely verbal activity, since it consists of us reading words and attributing meaning to them, he says in another sense it's mute. Reading reaches beyond words for Poulet into a kind of presence of one consciousness within another, that of the readers inside the authors. When the reading act is over, this presence vanishes, leaving the mind of the reader empty, ready to be invaded and possessed by another book or another mind. Moreover, the presence of one mind to another in reading is vivid, but it's also disordered. And J. Hillis Miller, a very famous Victorian critic, has a great essay on Poulet and Iser, which you can go and look up. It's not the Hillis Miller, actually, in your Lodgian Wood anthology, but you know, you should read that as well, because Hillis Miller's great. But Hillis Miller says that it's almost like when you're reading, it's like you've kind of moved into the space of the narrator's head. And he actually kind of puts it in this kind of moving van terms, where you kind of get all your stuff and all your furniture and kind of put it in the head and like move in for a bit and rearrange all your things so you're comfortable there, so that you can fully experience this kind of other person's head for a bit. But he says that, you know, because you're kind of only in there for a bit, all of your stuff's a bit messy. You haven't got time to properly nest. So all of your stuff's kind of junked in there. And I suppose what Hillis Miller is trying to say there is that even when you enter the consciousness of the narrator, your relationship to that narrator is a bit kind of all over the place. But that's good, because that all over the placeness, that lacking control of meaning, is what gives you the space to think in different ways. So for Poulet, the process of the reader putting in order all of their stuff in the mind's storeroom is what constitutes literary criticism. This means making sure everything that makes up the narrator's mind can sort of be related back to your own experience. The implication of this is that Poulet thinks that all the works of an author form a unity, but that all the parts of this unity function not as a logical sequence, but in a dialectical way. And what this means is that he wants to free critics from reading an author chronologically and get us to think instead about our own sense of how the text feels through our understanding of the mind and emotions of the author or the narrator in there. So in other words, he says, you know, there's no point like getting Jane Austen's complete works and starting with the one that she wrote first and then ending with the one she wrote at the end, and just and then tracing some sort of movement of Austen's mind through that, because that's a kind of false way to do it. That's not how your brain works. You don't think of things in a linear way. He says that what you should do is just kind of try and match the texts in terms of the different emotions that they create and explore them in terms of their emotional content rather than their historical content. Okay, so that sense of concentrating, I think, in a deep way on the author's consciousness is really what Poulet's pushing here. And I think what he wants to do is begin always with that idea of the analysis of consciousness, because there isn't anything that exists prior to consciousness. Just as for Heidegger, there isn't anything that exists prior to language. And I think that these ideas are particularly well worked out in that Iser essay, which I'll just return to finish off with. What Iser says is that Heidegger's understanding of language and Poulet's understanding of consciousness help us to see that a text is not, quote, a line of words releasing a single meaning, but, quote, a multidimensional space in which a variety of writings, none of them original, blend and clash. For Iser, the text is always just a blend of quotations from other cultures. So if phenomenology is always thinking about the experience of texts and the way in which texts are just a reflection of different people's experiences, there's only so many experiences in the world, right? So for Iser, all texts are kind of somehow a jigsaw or kind of bricolage of all the experiences that are always going around in the world. And so that what we need to do is kind of think about the way in which all those experiences might blend and clash, and how the poems help us to sort of separate them and reflect on them. So he wants us to stop kind of trying to make sense of words in a syntactical, straightforward way. So he says that the text is always just a blend of quotations from many cultures. And these ideas are helpful because not only do they lead us away from abstract discussions about what the author thought, but they also stop us from getting trapped in analyses of literary worth and originality. Isn't there no point saying, oh, Shakespeare is the greatest person who ever lived and all of his work's totally original? Because he, even when he's writing, he'll be kind of absorbing the works of other people and the ideas and consciousnesses of the actors that he's working with. So, you know, there's all these debates about who wrote Shakespeare's plays. Was it Bacon? Was it Shakespeare? Was it somebody else that we've never heard of? I mean, Iser says, who cares? You've got the text there. And even if we did know who wrote them, we're not going to have direct access to that person's consciousness. All we can do is try and get into the text and kind of separate out all the different consciousnesses that are in there and think about what our experience of them is. And I think that sense of kind of getting out of debates about literary worth is really interesting and helpful too, to stop us from kind of saying, this book's better than this book, this poem's better than this poem. You know, what's the point? Because the point is your experience of the text, not whether the poem's good or not. You can write an amazing essay about a poem that's not very good, and or a really bad essay about an amazing poem. You know, the emphasis for Iser, Heidegger, Poulet is on us, not on the text to kind of somehow, you know, not be good enough, if you like. So when we see the text as a complex of consciousnesses, the critic's task becomes one of disentangling these consciousnesses rather than deciphering which one is correct. As Iser says, phenomenology makes reading and literary criticism, quote, truly revolutionary, since to refuse to fix meaning is, in the end, to refuse reason, science, law. Now think about what the alternatives to reason, science, law are. Well, you know, you could say lots of different things, but, you know, feeling, imagination, liberty of ideas, you know, anarchy, ideas that deny hierarchies and kills off not only the author, but the critic who thinks he's right, and in doing so, puts other people off reading their texts. And I think that's particularly what happens with a lot of poetry, with a lot of texts that with a lot of books about what we call prosody, you know, the kind of techniques of scanning poetry and working out rhymes within them. Particularly that chap, what's his name? Derek, who's that guy at York who writes all those books on? Derek Attridge. Oh, his books, I mean, he's supposed to be like the greatest person in the world for kind of telling you about like how poetry works and how poetic form works. And, you know, they are good, they will tell you, but you know, God help you if you get it wrong and you don't do what Derek Attridge tells you to do. I mean, there's a sense in which his consciousness has become a kind of master consciousness without him even knowing it, because his ego is so central in all of the books that he's writing all the time that he's constantly saying, you know, read this line aloud and see where the stresses are. And then obviously where the stresses are is where he's put the stresses in his head, right? So that you're always getting this sense of feeling like you can't quite catch up with what he's saying because you're wrong, because, oh, well, I've put the stress in the wrong place so I don't get it anymore. You know, that kind of criticism is exactly what phenomenology is trying to get you out of, to say, you know, there's lots of different ways of reading this, and you have to kind of be able to reflect back on what your experience is and reflect back on your sense of being. And I think that reflection, that's the really hard thing to do, because you can't just turn to historical context to do it. You can't just turn to identity politics to do it. You have to really think about, you know, who you are. And I think to bring us back to what Heidegger says about authenticity, to think about why you're reading the way in which you are. You know, what are you doing? Have you got any integrity in this reading? Is there a reason that you're doing this? Is it only just because you've got to write an essay? Or do you really believe in the experience that you're having of the text and want to translate it, you know, into your essays? All right, well, I'll end there, and good luck with your essays.